Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 355. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are Guillaume Veillette.
Hello, hello.
And James Jones.
Yep.
And John Lindemann.
Johnny, it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, man, it's always a pleasure to be with you guys. And we are here. This is a special episode because we're going to have so much good stuff to talk about. We're very happy. We're in a good mood. We're optimistic and we're positive. Wii U sales are up 200% increase over last month.
But so two have sold as opposed to
four, John. Yeah. Four have sold.
I think they still didn't break 100,000, but it's a big improvement, obviously. So there are things to look forward to. We got Mario coming out in not too long from now, and some other stuff too. So. We're actually going to be talking about some of our favorite things going on in the world of Nintendo in the second part of this show. Just like, not even like, no nostalgia, you know, not like, man, remember when Nintendo was awesome back in the 80s or 1992 or whatever? No, we're going to talk about the things that we are super happy about right now with Nintendo. So that's the feature topic. A little corny, but...
I'm going to throw some curveballs, and I think you all need to throw curveballs in this segment.
I'm going to try.
If you say, I like Mario, I'm going to fucking come and grot you.
but I do like Mario.
I don't fucking give
a
shit.
I'm really happy about the Nintendo logo. I really like it.
No, it should be red, John. Stop
I'm
it.
All about the Nintendo official seal. No, but we are going to get into that in the second half of the show. But as always, we're kicking it off with new business. And it's been a little bit of a slow week, I guess, for us gaming-wise, at least most of us.
Yes.
James has been sick. He's usually our stalwart. I guess I've been playing the most interesting things, so I'll kick it off. I've been gaming a lot on my Wii U this week. Like, this is the first really week that I've had a Wii U since the flood. So, you know, I had basically just got it turned on before we recorded last week, and that's why I had only played Zelda for like 15 minutes. At this point, I've played Zelda for at least 10 hours, probably. Because that game's real addictive, and you know, all the changes that they made in the HD version really do make it flow a lot better, and those I really appreciate, especially as someone who's played the game more than once all the way through. I played a little bit of the English version several years ago. I didn't get very far, but I played and beat the game in Japanese in the first place. So for me, it's like, you know, stuff like the Swift Sail, which is annoyingly hard to get. That really should be a lot easier to get, or it should be in a much less stupid place in the game. I think they should have just added that to, I don't know, somewhere that you are more likely to find it accidentally, rather than it have to be something that you pretty much have to tell people about, or you have to go look it up online. Because it's in the auction house, but it won't show up until like the third or fourth time probably that you go in there, and even then you have to have 200 or 300 rupees to buy it. So you could easily get overbid the first time if it just came up by surprise. So I think stuff like that, it's like, come on guys, if you're going to put this in the game and everyone loves it and you know everyone's going to really like this, why don't you just make it part of the game instead of making this a really obscure secret? But I am glad it's in there. And the Swift Sail, I just got it a couple nights ago. It makes a pretty big difference in how long it takes to get around. And I remember I got to try it just very briefly at E3, and I wasn't really impressed by how much faster it is. And I think over like short distances, which is all I was doing in the demo back at E3, over short distances, if anything, it actually makes it kind of harder, especially if you're trying to pinpoint, like if you're trying to get up to a grapple spot in the water so you can dig down and try to salvage something, or if you're trying to, you know, ease up to an enemy or up to an island or something, it's hard to use the Swift Sail, and it's really not for those purposes. But where you really appreciate it is when you do have to go long distances. You're like, I need to get to this island that's 3 squares away and I don't have the cyclone yet, or something like that. That's when it makes a really big difference. And I think it's great, you know, the fact that you don't have to change the wind all the time. It makes it much less realistic. It makes it much more like a driving game where you basically just kind of point the direction and let it go. You don't have to worry about wind anymore. And so, I, like, in a sense, I feel like this probably would not be ideal if this is your first time playing. Because I do feel like part of the experience of what makes Wind Waker so special is that it is slow to move around, and it does take a long time, and it sort of forces you to be more patient, and to it sort of changes your expectation of how long it should take to get somewhere. And I know a lot of people hate that, and it gets on me, especially towards the end of the game, because you just like, look, I've been to this place before. I just want to get there now. I don't care about the journey anymore. I've had that. I just want to get to the destination. And that's natural by the end of the game. I think it's also natural if you've already played through this whole game before and you're just trying to cruise through it again for shits and giggles, you know, which is basically what I'm doing. So it's perfect for me, having already played through the entire game, for them to have, you know, they really have kind of sanded down all the burrs on the game, and they've made it just go so much more smoothly. They've shortened a lot of animations that you will encounter very frequently. They have added things to the map that make it easier to find what you might be looking for. They've done some things. I've only barely started the Triforce quest, so I'm not real clear on the changes they've made there. Maybe I'll have more to report next week on that. But in a number of ways, they have made the game just flow a lot better. And I, you know, again, having played the game before, I really appreciate that. But if this is your first time playing Wind Waker, I might say maybe don't get the Swift Sail until later in the game, because I do feel like it might reduce the experience just a little bit for people.
Does it make the world feel smaller?
Yeah, it does. And it's funny, because before I got it, when I was had just started playing the game, I was just getting the boat and sort of, you know, just getting the ability to roam around. A lot of different things occurred to me that maybe I hadn't really realized back in 2002 and 2003, which is that, you know, this is kind of like the only really open world Zelda game, in the sense that it is.
Yeah, I mean, it is.
It gives you so much freedom to go around and explore. And you can get into so many bad situations because you really shouldn't be doing that stuff yet. But the game lets you.
I mean, it is. But I mean, in a literal sense, it is literally the only open world Zelda game. I mean, it's.
The very first Zelda is pretty open also.
Yeah, but I mean, the only time you encounter any breaks, though, is when you go inside buildings. I mean, when you're out there, it's just constant flow.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, the fact that like the ocean and the Windfall Island, for instance, the big village in the game, are completely continuous. So there's no loading screen. There's no screen wipe where it's like, oh, you know,
not even a little pan like you get in the first Zelda.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point. And that, I think, does give the sense of scale in the world, where you see something far off and you can actually watch it. As you get closer and closer and closer to it, it becomes more and more and more detailed until finally you're there. And there's no magic break in between. There's no edit. That's a really good point, actually. But the other thing I realize is that, I mean, the world is almost too big. This world has to be at least 10 or 20 times bigger than any other Zelda game. And that's a weird thing for them to do. And obviously, it's very sparsely populated with things. You know, I mean, you'll find a rupee on your way to something else, or maybe a bird will come down and attack you. But for the most part, there's just long stretches in between places of interest where there's really nothing going on. And like, again, in a sense, I feel like that's kind of a cool creative choice, and that it really does sometimes force you to just kind of sit there and wait for the game to do something. And it gives you a chance to appreciate the grandeur of the art design and of this beautiful music that's playing, and, you know, and the ability to swing the camera all around. I mean, I think the boat really is kind of the perfect showcase for the camera system in this game, because if you think about the previous Zelda game, Majora's Mask and Ocarina of Time had very stodgy camera systems where you had no direct camera control except you could hit Z to just snap it back. Right. To Link. Otherwise, the camera would be pushed around by the walls around you and stuff like that. But I mean, you couldn't control it at all. In this game, it's just like Mario Sunshine. You can fling the camera around 360 degrees anytime in the entire game. It's a huge difference just cinematically and letting you set up your own camera angles and view things from the way you want to. Like, I fought that boss about halfway through the game, that boss at the Forsaken Fortress where you have to play the ping pong match with the energy blast, right? And you have to swing the Master Sword to fling the energy back at the boss. And in this game, it's so much easier than Ocarina because you can just tilt the camera over to the side and actually view the whole thing in profile. Yeah. You couldn't even imagine doing that in Ocarina of Time.
And to me, both the continuous loading and the ability to just pan the camera around really is almost required to have pulled off this sort of sea exploration they're going for. Yeah. Because if you think about what it was like on a boat sailing to unknown shores, you really were looking all around, looking for any sign of land.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I remember when I first played the game and I just set sail into the uncharted ocean. And I would just look around, and if I saw something on the horizon, there's the Z button for the telescope. Just pull that thing on out and zoom on in, see what you're looking at, and see if you want to keep going that way. It was a very exciting sense of discovery that really doesn't happen in games very much.
Well, it certainly doesn't happen in something like Skyward Sword.
No.
You know,
it's pretty planned out where you go.
Right.
It's pretty obvious.
Well, yeah, I mean, the sky in Skyward Sword is way smaller than the ocean in Wind Waker, which mm-hmm. is kind of silly if you think
but
about it.
But it's smaller.
It is three-dimensional, but
yeah.
That part doesn't really factor in a whole lot.
It's smaller, but it feels more empty because everything's so spread out and there's nothing going on.
Yeah.
Like Wind Waker, where there's these little islands that maybe they're not really relevant to the game and you could go the whole game and never set foot on them.
Yeah, it's like
they're there.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah.
Yeah, like that's the thing. It's not like you have this sense of, you know, you'll come across stuff that's actually useful to you. It's like most of the time it's just dead space just out there that you just have to traverse.
I mean, the quests where you had to go to, what was it, the Pumpkin Ranch?
Mm-hmm.
Which is just way, way, way far from the main town. It was the worst feelings I had from Wind Waker. Just constant back and forth to the damn ranch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in Wind Waker, one thing I like is that you might have a destination in mind, but there's plenty of stuff on the way that might distract you or that might pull you away and sort of give you another quest to sort of get focused on for a while. And I feel like that's not really a possibility in Skyward Sword.
No, because, mm-hmm. I mean, you set off from the main island, you could see it, and then you just set the controller and just went and hoped you didn't get attacked by birds.
Yeah.
And that was disappointing.
Well, I'm not quite to the point in Wind Waker where you'd have to start dealing with a lot of the partner AI stuff. Which I remember being very irritated by, and I'll be curious to see if they've done anything to really make that any better.
I don't recall having problems with them. Like, didn't they just fold you at your heels and, you know, like you positioned them where you need them, basically?
I don't know. I mean, there are some problems sometimes. I've had some issues, even in the Tower of the Goddesses, you know, controlling those statues. There's a range, you know, you have to be close enough to do it, and they move very slowly, and they kind of follow you, but they'll fall off of ledges if you cut the corner too sharply, and there's some stuff like that that I found sort of irritating. I mean, I think it is ambitious in the sense that this was almost like Nintendo sort of flirting with the idea of making like co-op Zelda dungeons, you know, where you control both characters, but at least they're setting up puzzles that require two people to solve, and they sort of let you put the pieces where you want to. But the problem with one person controlling two characters is that you don't really do it at the same time. This isn't Brothers on Xbox 360, you know, where you literally control two characters at the same time with two joysticks. This is, I move one piece, then I play a song, then I move the other piece, then I play the song, then I move, you know, and it's like, it stretches things out. It's very slow, and you know, I think they have done a couple things again in this game. Like when you use the Wind Waker, it doesn't repeat the song after you play it, which is something that's irritated me going all the way back to at least Ocarina, where, you know, they ask you to put in this pattern on your musical instrument and you do that and it makes the sound as you input. But then when it's over, it repeats the whole thing over again. It's like, why would you do that? I just played the song. Now you're playing it again. This whole animation could have taken half as long. And this is something like in Majora when you have to play that cloning song over and over. It just, you know, like anything you can do to shorten that mechanic will make the game play better. And they've done a lot of smart things in Wind Waker HD to improve that. So it does give me a lot of hope for the next Zelda, which we haven't seen yet. We don't know much about. I mean, there was that demo at E3 a couple of years ago where they just wanted to show the HD-ness.
Look at these graphics!
It's a spider!
It looked good, but I wouldn't say it looked as good as I'm hoping for. You know, I felt it was a very functional demo, but...
It wasn't very inventive either. It was just like, yep, okay, that's kind of how every single person in the world would think that a realistic Zelda would look like, so...
It seemed thrown together very quickly.
Yeah, it probably was. I mean, it was
exactly.
It was that and the sit on a car as it drives through Shinjuku. I mean, we weren't dealing with a lot of great Wii U demos.
Right. Right. So, but yeah, I mean, I have to say I am enjoying Wind Waker an awful lot. Like I said, it's a lot harder to put down because the game just, it's paced even better than before. And I'm finding myself playing it 3-4 hours at a time when I really have other things I should be doing, but, you know, I just want to keep playing it. It's just a world that I think I missed being in this world, and nothing really has scratched that itch since Wind Waker first came out. Certainly not the DS games, which are fine, but they don't nearly capture the grandeur and charm.
There's a platform the GameCube challenge, game. Obviously.
There's some technical challenges with those as well, but they also just the way that you, like for instance in Phantom Hourglass, the way that you sail on the boat by drawing the path on the touchscreen, it's not even close to being as much fun as just directly controlling the boat. So there's a big difference there, you know, but it certainly does make me more excited for A Link Between Worlds. I was already pretty excited about that, but you know, just seeing the ingenuity and the thoughtfulness that's gone into some of the changes that they've made in this one, it really does give me a lot of hope for where they're taking this series going forward. And, you know, if nothing else, I think having Wind Waker HD out now, it gave me an excuse to play through a game that I really, really love. I gave it a 10, I think, on the website when I did the import review. So clearly, I was always a fan of Wind Waker. But I think I had forgotten just how much I loved it, and also why I loved it so much the first time. I had like a kind of a vague sense of, oh yeah, man, that game's really pretty, and I really like the story, and I really like sailing around on the ocean. But I think there's a lot of other more subtle touches to it in the way that it's presented, like the cinematics and the animations, and the music is really wonderful. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of things like that that had kind of faded for me. And so, you know, now more than 10 years later, it's really been worthwhile to play through it again. And I think it's sort of its place in my list of personal favorite Zelda games has definitely been rising as I've played through it again in this new version.
Yeah, I mean,
so
for me, it probably has the most perfect sort of overworld tune, the do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Like, it's just so great.
It is great.
You always hear it when you come out of something, and it's just like, ah, a bright, fresh new world to explore. You know, it just has that feeling to it, you know what I mean? It's so great. Yeah.
From a musical standpoint, without getting into musical technicalities, the ability for them to weave in a sort of semi-nautical theme into every song, but especially the I'm trying to remember what the island is with the Dragon Roost Island,
mm-hmm.
which is a very, very nautical themed song. It sort of is consistent in ways that Zelda music usually isn't.
Right.
Yeah. It's more of a consistent motif. And, you know, that it's funny, playing through Dragon Roost Island, now that it's been almost a week ago now that I did that, so the feeling has faded for me now that I've played through other parts of the game afterward. But at that moment when I was playing through that first dungeon, it made me really, really nostalgic for E3 2002. Because that dungeon was the demo for Wind Waker. And that was the first time anyone played Wind Waker. It was the first time they'd shown it whatsoever since that very controversial TGS unveiling back in 2001. So that was really my first like clean impression of the game. And I remember coming out of that E3 thinking, this is an awesome Zelda game. Like, it looks way, way better than I would have expected. And it just really feels like it has something going on under the hood that really makes it feel different than the 3D Zelda games that we had before. And it really did. That was like the best E3 ever. You know, that was the year they showed Sunshine and also Metroid Prime for the first time. So it was probably the best E3 I've ever been to back in 2002. And like playing that dungeon, it's really weird that playing a game would make me nostalgic for a very specific E3, but I had that feeling I don't think I've ever felt that way before, really. So it's been very, very lovely experience playing through. So why don't I take a break? I have more games to talk about, but why don't I flip it over to Guillaume to talk about a game?
Yeah, sure. A game perhaps as epic as Wind Waker is. Last week was Canadian Thanksgiving, so I wanted to get some 3DS games and some cheap ones. So I went through my wish list and I downloaded some of the cheapest games I could find on there. And I ended up downloading Castlevania: The Adventure, the Game Boy, the first Game Boy Castlevania game,
the notorious, I would say.
I really felt like playing Castlevania game, and what I really wanted to play was Castlevania 3 because I never went through that one. But it's not on the 3DS Virtual Console, and also I already bought it on Wii. I don't want to pay twice for the same game. So I thought, well, this is the next best thing, I guess, and boy, does it fall short of everything that a Castlevania game can be. If you've ever thought that Simon Belmont in Castlevania games was slow as hell, there's even slower. He's got some ancestors or some descendants that just probably, I don't know, just came out of a hospital. They've got broken legs and they're just trying to shamble forward. It's one of the slowest. It's really infuriating. You're just trying to get from one end of a tiny screen to the other end of the tiny screen, and somehow that takes forever. Other characteristics, like this game is missing a lot of staples of Castlevania games. You don't get power-ups. Like, you do upgrade your whip, and eventually the whip can shoot projectiles somehow. Right. But you cannot get any, you know, like the axes or the cross or anything like that. So really, it's always, you're going to be fighting the same two or three enemy types, always with a whip. And yeah, I am running out of things to say here. It's super short. I thought it would be at least 5 levels long, but it's 4 levels. And they all kind of seemed samey to me. and not all of that is because the game is monochrome. It's also, there's not that much variation in the levels. This game has faded so quickly from my memory. I don't even recall if you make your way through Dracula's castle. I do remember you going through some nondescript exterior place, and then some nondescript caves, and then it's a blur. I don't remember anything.
My memories of this game are a blur too, but I do recall a lot of climbing up ropes.
Yep. Instead of the infamous Castlevania stairs, which are really hard to get on and off of, you climb on ropes, and there's not really anything special about it except that it's slow, and you're climbing up ropes. So that's a new thing, I guess.
So you climb up these ropes as slowly as you do the stairs.
Yeah, basically. At least you don't really get attacked by enemies when you're doing so. So that's an improvement, I suppose.
But can you get knocked off the ropes, though?
There's not really any enemies. It's really weird.
Yeah.
I guess like the fact is they made this game when the Game Boy was super new, and perhaps they didn't figure out how to have many enemies at once on the screen, so they just did whatever they could. Actually, I think I had some slowdown even when there were two or three enemies. So really, they were struggling with the hardware. And
it's a very, very early Game Boy game.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, it's not just that it's early, it's just badly designed. It violates every platformer law. That unspoken, unwritten platformer law that I can think of. For instance, you know, when you're underground and there's spikes in front of you underground on the floor, you just have to touch them and you die. Like, even if you still have one foot on the platform, if you just so much as touch those spikes, you die. The character doesn't jump very far. And there's a lot of platforming going on. Like, it really wants you to step from one falling platform to the next very quickly. It's really hard to do. And so you always have to be on the very tip of the platform. And if there are spikes, well, that's actually the one time where you're supposed to really watch it and jump from a little bit further. So yeah, and so 4 levels, and when you beat the game, you see the short credits, and then it's stage 5, and stage 5 is just stage 1, a little bit harder. I can't actually tell what the differences are. There seems to be the same amount of enemies, and I don't seem to be taking more damage, so I don't know. Like, it's just, okay, beat the game. Now play it forever.
Well, the good news for this series is I've heard, although I've never played it, but I've heard Castlevania The Adventure 2 is much, much, much better.
Yeah, but I kind of wonder, why can't we have gotten that game instead?
Well, why did we get Urban Champion today on Wii U? I don't know.
I don't understand why these companies feel the need to go through these games.
The need still burns for Urban Champion.
I mean, who is nostalgic for Castlevania the Adventure? Like, when I was a kid, I was like 8 years old, and I was like, this sucks. And I liked Castlevania back then.
Right.
Ugh. No one wanted this, except you. You might have been the only person who had it on your wish list.
Yeah, but I had never played it back in the day. That's the thing. I wanted to see what the, you know, I had heard it was bad, but I, you know, your mind doesn't really understand how bad it is until you play it for yourself.
You just weren't prepared for the for the truth.
And I just wish that Konami had just went and released Castlevania The Adventure 2 right away, you know, because why bother with the first one? There's no need on the Virtual Console to adhere to the order that they were released in. There's no need for that. They're old games. Just give us the best ones first.
Because they want you to buy the worst ones and then buy the best ones later.
But then they don't release the best one. That's the thing.
Maybe later.
Maybe.
They just keep you hanging. You always got to keep customers coming back, right? You know?
So if the really shitty first one sells well enough, maybe they'll release the actually good second one.
Yeah, am I the only one who sees the flaw in this plan?
You know, I think you're crazy. For Capcom on Wii U, they released a bunch of Street Fighter games at the same time, which is smart because then you can just pick the one that you prefer, the one that you grew up with.
Right.
And they also released all three Final Fight games on Super Nintendo at the same time. They actually gave you a discount if you bought all of them, which seems crazy, but I'm sure someone used it.
Yeah.
But if you're like, man, the first Final Fight really sucks on Super Nintendo. It doesn't even have two-player mode, but Final Fight 2 and 3 do. Buy those instead. Like, I think it's great that they give you the choice, you know?
Absolutely.
And, I mean, Konami could learn a lot from that, but then Konami is not even nearly as good at re-releasing their classic stuff as Capcom and Nintendo are.
Oh, no.
Capcom's maybe, like, the best of anybody. I mean, they're really,
I don't
really,
want to talk
really...
about this, Johnny. I own Mega Man X3 four different ways.
Yeah.
I don't want to have this conversation.
That's a good game to own four times.
Yeah. I mean, they started doing it so much, they actually had to scale back. They were like, we're not going to put any more remakes on PSN or anything like that. So,
yeah, it had gotten so out of hand that they had to basically, like, do a public mea culpa.
Yeah.
Like,
I think the game that actually broke them was, I think, one of the Darkstalkers titles.
Yeah.
I think.
Darkstalkers?
Yeah. It came out and it sold nothing, and they're like, okay, we're not going to do this anymore.
Nice.
Darkstalkers.
They kind of flooded the market there for a while.
You flood the Darkstalkers market?
Yeah.
Ty spent all his money on the last Darkstalkers game. Is it enough to buy a next one?
All right. So, James, why don't you give us a Ni No Kuni update? Has it been redeemed?
No.
Is it worse?
No. I mean, I've only tacked on about, as Johnny mentioned in the open, I've been sick or busy pretty much nonstop since Friday, and so I haven't, and this is recorded on Thursday, that means I haven't had a lot of chance to play the game. I've tacked on about 4-ish hours since then, so I'm through, I guess, what is the third town. So we've gotten to the point where you can do alchemy, which means you're constantly going into the book and just trying to read it.
Did you struggle with beating that genie to get the alchemy pot?
I did, actually.
I found him to be incredibly difficult.
So here's the reason I found him difficult, is that the AI character sucks. She's terrible. You can control her, yeah. But then
you can reprogram her a little bit.
But. A little bit, yeah. But so what we're referring to is, as you play the game, you get another – so it's you, and then you can control these familiars. But later in the game, roughly 5, 6, 7 hours in, you get another person who also has familiars, and they are controlled by the AI. There's some basic level of, you know, say, you attack, give it your all, hold back, defend, or do nothing, or keep us alive. And what I found is that keep us alive translates into AI speak of run directly into the enemy's special attack. So I took me about 3 times to beat the genie. It just happened that I babysat her and didn't make sure, it made sure she didn't die. But the first time I was playing it, she died in like less than a minute and a half. It was truly an impressive feat by the game. The other problem with that genie, though, is they don't tell you a boss is coming. They just sort of like...
Right.
You kind of wander into town and there's an event that leads you astray. And if you don't know that you need to go heal up and you've just gone through hell to get there, it's probably not going to go well for you. And yeah. I hope to God you save before you got into town, because otherwise, guess what?
Yeah, I think it's one of the very few places in the game where a boss is not telegraphed.
Yeah.
It's pretty unfair. I want to say at that point in the game, you don't yet have the ability to tell your allies to defend or attack, like all at the same time.
Right.
Because later on, you kind of get this shout ability where you can sort of, you can control the flow of the battle.
That would
a little
be
bit
tremendous. Because all you can do is
without
give
big, having to directly control them.
Yeah. All you can do is give these really general guidelines of, you know, hey, be the healer, be the aggressor, stuff like that. And you can give directive of attack the same target I'm attacking or attack a different target.
Yeah.
It's not great. What I did enjoy, though, is the dungeon before you go to this town, which is like the Tower of Trials or something along those lines.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is not really a dungeon at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's a couple of different stages of trials. They quote the Trial of Friendship, the Trial of Intelligence, and the Trial of Power.
It's like the end of The Last Crusade.
A little bit.
It does involve like treading along a very precarious.
Yeah. So like the trial of friendship is. It's funny, Johnny mentioned it. It's like playing two brothers.
That game Brothers.
Yeah. Huh.
Essentially, with the right control stick, you control one of the characters, and the left one, you control the other. And there's these there's this really narrow path that appears in front of them as they walk, but to keep you moving behind you, the path is falling away. So there's this. This internal dispute of, do I control one and make sure I don't screw it up really badly, or do I try to control them both at the same time, potentially mess it up, or do I sort of alternate, you know, all right, I can run them both now, and sometimes one needs to get somewhere to let the other one progress. It's actually a particularly challenging piece of platforming in an RPG. It was enjoyable.
It's very clever, actually.
The Trial of Intelligence, you're in this room and there's really no indicator of what you're supposed to do, except that you're supposed to use magic to move these statues around. I do wish they just told you the hint versus making you know you have to ask the bird, hey, give me the hint for this room so I can solve this dumb puzzle. but there's a little bit of clever puzzle solving in those, and then the Trial of Power is just a boss battle. It is what it is. But it was much more enjoyable than the run-of-the-mill dungeons I've had in the game thus far, so I was kind of hoping there'd be more of that. But I don't know, because then they made you climb up this volcano, and that was kind of like, So,
volcano's really pretty, though.
It is really pretty. The volcano is awesome looking.
Oh, is that the part in the demo?
Yes.
Oh, you never played the demo?
I didn't
play
the
demo. That part in the demo is, the demo in general is terrible.
Yeah.
Because the battle system has a lot of weird quirks to it, and they don't tell you how to use it at all.
Right, but when you're climbing the volcano, isn't there like rocks falling and you have to avoid them or something?
No, there's like fire shooting out of the wall and stuff.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and there's a 3-minute timer on it, and then at the end it's like, I guess what? Timer didn't matter. You're like, oh, game, fuck off. I don't need this from you. it's when I'm just goofing around with the game, it's fine and I'm enjoying it. It's just sometimes, like, especially when the game's like, go here, go here, go here, go here, go here. And it's not really impelling you forward. It's just telling you to do it. It's kind of dreary. I will say that the part where it sends you back to your world to help out somebody in this world through their related characters, specifically the girl you end up partnering with, that was actually kind of a nice scene in storytelling wise. You know, it was a really intimate moment that the game portrayed well. Versus some of the other intimate moments where the game's kind of, you know, it's not always hitting. So that was nice. It was nice that it clicked well for that moment. So it gave me some faith that there'll be more of those downstream. It's just, sometimes the game just doesn't quite nail the right note, if that makes sense.
I think if you like that part, there definitely are some other things later in the game that mirror that kind of experience.
Okay, that's good.
And that mode of storytelling. The story is, it's weird. The story starts off on a really serious note.
Oh yeah,
you see your mother get killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but no, you are responsible for your mother getting killed.
Yeah, it's your fault that your mother drowns.
Yeah,
and that's the start of the game. You're like, wow, this is fucked up. And then the game seems to get kind of like very, very lighthearted for a long time.
It's kind of weird how lighthearted it gets.
Right. But then gradually it brings back in those darker notes that it started out with, actually. And by the end of the game, it's pretty dark.
Yeah, I mean, that particular scene is particularly dark because, I mean, it deals very cleanly with the issue of spousal abuse.
Yeah.
I mean, you actually see an instant of a husband essentially hitting his wife.
Yeah, and the wife is, you know, clearly very sort of psychologically damaged.
Yeah,
it's clear this is not a one-time thing.
No, and the fact is you're trying to help their daughter who is deeply emotionally scarred by it.
Yeah, which, you know, if you look at this and you think, wow, this looks like a Disney or a Pixar thing, that could really throw you off. If you realize this is Studio Ghibli and they do deal with darker themes, more adult themes in a lot of their movies, even though they may be animated, they may be very cute.
Right.
I think that will help you. But it's weird because, you know, when you first see Ni No Kuni, it looks maybe something more along the lines of Ponyo or My Neighbor Totoro.
Right.
But overall, it's the overall tone of it, I would say, it probably gets a lot closer to like Mononoke or certainly Spirited Away, which has some pretty dark themes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's sort of the vibe they're going for. Because, I mean, at the whole time, you're trying to essentially... There is some element of darkness everywhere versus these sort of small internalized conflicts that you get in their more, you know, lighthearted stuff.
Yeah,
a lot of those are overcoming personal adversity, whereas this is just straight up like shit's got real in this land. You need to deal with it.
So James, you're at the part where you now have you should have all three party members, and. The weird thing is because you said they each have their own familiars, it ends up being a lot like playing a Pokemon game where you had a not just a party of Pokemon, but a party of trainers.
Yeah.
And so each trainer has their own set of Pokemon and they swap them out and they use all their different abilities. And then also the trainers themselves have their own abilities and they can fight too in place of a Pokemon. And so the battles become really chaotic. Because there's, you know, there's three different trainers running around with potentially three different Pokemon, and they're all doing weird stuff, and you're not really directly controlling.
Yeah, and you'll see them do things, and you're like, "What the fuck did you do that for?"
I think the AI, it's not that it gets better over time, but it has more agency as you get
more tools to handle it.
Right. You get more familiars that have more different kinds of abilities, and also the game will eventually give you more options on how to control those other characters. So
it reminds me a little bit, and this is again, a little bit, of the feeling you get the first time you go into a battle in the game, The Last Remnant, where there's just shit going on everywhere. You're like, ah, what am I doing? Because there's like parties that are fighting just off screen, fighting other enemy parties that you can't directly influence, but occasionally like an enemy will cross from their side to your side and just start going ape shit on you. And it's like, oh my God, there's so much stuff going on right now. I don't understand anything. And then eventually it's just, it all starts to slow down. You can kind of follow what's going on, but there's always kind of a sense of there is a little bit of disorganized chaos here that you need to get a handle on because it can get really out of hand fast. the djinn that you get in the cauldron is the ultimate example of getting super out of hand. Yeah. But unless he pulls out the parasol, everything's great. It's such a fucking weird boss.
For sure. All right, so John, why don't you tell us what you've been playing?
Well, to surprise nobody, I've been playing some more Monster Hunter on 3DS mainly, just because it's pretty much the perfect, you know. I was thinking about this, and I can see why this game is so big in Japan, because this is the perfect type of game to play on the train. Because, you know, I take the train to work now, and with every mission being capped at 50 minutes, that's just pretty much the perfect time to, you know, get the whole thing done in a good train ride, if you have a reasonable commute. So, so I'm at the point now where I've pretty much gone through all of the first... I think I'm at the last quest in 4 stars, which isn't really too far necessarily, but still I've poured about 40 hours into the game now, so which is a lot for me, but it's more because I can play it on the go. So mm-hmm. any kind of dead time that I have on the train, I can just, you know, what's up next? And it's very, and the way it's sequenced is, hey, you beat this quest, shut it down, play it tomorrow, start the next quest.
I remember when I played through Dragon Quest IX, I was like, I played 100 hours?
Yeah.
How? How does this happen?
Yeah. And it's just, you can do it because you can do it in very, it's not even bite-sized chunks. It's like just very, it's almost like chapters, you know?
Yeah.
You know,
it's
like
discrete chunks. Like if you have a feeling, like if you know before you start the mission, like the maximum time that it might take you, that makes it easier for you to justify playing that mission because it's not an open-ended commitment.
Yep.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, another thing that's really handy is you can just shut your 3DS and it just pauses it and you can pick it back up. Like that's what I'll do too. If I'm in a particularly, you know, difficult fight, you know, and I'm already at work, I get to work and, you know, I'm not done with it. I just shut my 3DS, throw it in my bag. And then when I go home, I just pick right back up where I left off. So that's really, really handy. But the fight I'm on right now is I'm fighting the Lagiacrus, which is, I believe, the kind of mascot monster for the game. So I'm expecting once I beat him, I had him almost down. I had him almost dead. But he, what tends to happen is you can kind of get caught where a monster will stun you and then hit you 3 times in a row. And because you're stunned, you can't heal yourself. So. And of course, you only have 3 lives for any one mission, so I got fainted out, you could say. So, but but yeah, but I mean, it's still great. I'm getting to the point where I'm really kind of starting to exercise all of everything, you know, all the tools I have, kind of thing. Like, you know, I'm planting stuff in the farm, and I'm you know, I'm sending out the fishing boats because there's all of these kind of, you know, sub questy kind of things where, you know, you can open up new places to farm, you know, new kind of like, you know, new soil to farm in your homestead kind of thing. And you know, so you can plant more stuff and harvest more stuff at one time and get kind of, you know, rare stuff every once in a while.
When did this turn into Harvest Moon?
It's that's the thing. I mean, they just, you know, I'm really wondering because
it's closer to Rune Factory, to be fair. Come on.
Fair. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, all of this stuff is it's like you kind of have a choice. Like you can kind of choose to self, you know, kind of grow everything yourself, or you can buy certain things through the store. But of course, the rarest stuff you have to create yourself. But yeah, I mean, I can completely see this. I really don't know really why this isn't some sort of MMO, because it has all the trappings of it, you know? And so, I don't know. It's just interesting.
Didn't they announce like a weird kind of PC-only free-to-play Monster Hunter in Japan?
There's some sort of like, is it Monster Hunter Frontier G? I think that's what I saw. I know there's a new Monster Hunter game coming to Wii U and PS3, and I think that's Monster Hunter Frontier G, which was out on 360.
Yeah. No, it's not that one. I think it's a Chinese company or a Korean company is making a new Monster Hunter. I heard them talking about it on 8-4 Play, and they seem to think it looked terrible.
Yeah, I think it's only for China, I think.
Okay.
It's not for North America or anything like that. But
But
yeah, I mean, I'm still really enjoying it. So
if you ever played a Chinese RPG, you understand why.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm looking forward to actually, you know, getting online. I haven't really done that yet, and I'm okay with that just because I feel like I'm getting to the point now where my armor is good enough, and, you know, like I'm getting to the point too where I want to start, you know, getting armor sets and stuff like that. So, you know, getting online, really, like, farming just by yourself is difficult. It takes you so long. You can't really farm effectively. It's much easier. I mean, especially when you have to farm some of the monsters that are kind of mid-tier. With a group, you would just be able to just carve through them really easily. Whereas when it's by yourself, I mean, all the monsters take a while if you're just hacking at them solo.
Do you have to divide up the spoils with a group if you play online?
No, I don't believe so.
So everybody gets a copy of whatever the thing is?
Yep. Because that was one of the things I was wondering, and somebody said that you don't split it. You just get your own spoils. So
sounds like you have nothing to lose.
I got nothing to lose. In general.
That's right. With life.
See, I think the idea, though, of not disincentivizing group play is good, because ultimately group play is what makes a lot of games addictive. And Monster Hunter is goal. Its reason to be is to addict you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, but sometimes a little bit of competition is also an incentive to play as a group. I mean,
yeah.
But see, the competition can come from, all right, who can down the biggest thing?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yep.
Maybe not like the spoils, but perhaps like give some sort of special reward if you did the most damage to the boss or something mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
See, that's racist against healers. Healers have a role too.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's are there healers in Monster Hunter?
No, there are no healers. I mean, you have different types of attacks, range attacks, and you know melee right. attacks. But I mean, that's one of the right. other things I'm learning too. Is I mean, the only class really I've ever played is just the Blade Master or you know that where you swing a great sword. So what I have to do most of the time, one of the things you learn over time is how the monsters attack, and pretty much they attack, you know, kind of like north, south, east, or west of them. So a lot of times you can just sidestep their attack. And so you kind of learn to, you know, even if you're fighting a monster you haven't fought before, you can kind of figure out, you know, how they attack and then just sort of, you know, because they all attack the same way. And basically, if you just stay at angles, they typically have a hard time hitting you unless they're doing some kind of like AoE tail sweep attack that just hits everything around them. So, you know, I've become a lot better at that. So so it's easier even to tackle, you know, sort of these harder monsters like the one I'm fighting right now. So. You know, like I often find that I can just kind of like roll into the monster because just like you can walk right into the monster, like just, you know, they don't hurt you just, you know, by walking up to them. So you can like walk into them and it doesn't hurt you. So you can kind of just always with, you know, something that always works with every monster is kind of getting right into the center of them because their attacks are always like kind of at the perimeter, right? So you can like kind of walk up to the center and just start hacking away at them. So that's what a lot of times what I do with my greatsword.
That's how I play Mario Tennis. Right up on the net, Waluigi.
Right up on the
every
net.
Every day.
That's right.
So I'll go again, and I want to talk about a Wii U game that has come up a couple times on the show over this year, and it's Tokitori 2. But they recently, the developers recently sent out a patch or an update to the game to, I think, bring it up to speed with the PC version, the Steam version that came out over the summer. And this one's called Tokitori 2 Plus. So if you already bought the game, you get the Plus version for free. And if you buy the game now, you automatically get Plus. And Guy, you didn't talk about this, did you, while I was gone?
No, but Greg has.
Oh, Greg talked about it. Okay.
Yeah, but he never played the original version, so we couldn't. It was hard to compare the differences.
Right. So I did play the original. I bought it right when it first came out on Wii U back in like February or whenever that was. And you know, it was after that because the first time I saw it was at PAX East. So it probably came out like around April or May. Mm-hmm. But I found the game very enchanting, even from that demo at PAX East. I was like, this is so beautiful. It's so charming. You know, it has a visual language to it that is really interesting. It almost like, Oddworld, Abe's Odyssey, you know, very similar in that the game doesn't really have text. It shows you what to do and what works and what doesn't work right. based on just purely animations and character expressions. And you know, it very similar actually in a lot of ways. It's very much a 2D game, but it has really beautiful kind of 3D depth animations to it. And, you know, but the game, I also found it so frustrating and oftentimes even infuriating because it's very non-linear. And I felt a lot of times I felt like I wasn't really going where I was supposed to go. I felt like there must be a sort of an ideal path for your first time through here. And I feel like I'm taking a wrong turn and then I get way, way off track. And I get, you know, kind of deep down a rabbit hole that I can't really get myself out of. And now I'm faced with a puzzle where I feel like I don't really know enough about the world to figure out this puzzle. I mean, it's never a matter of I don't have the abilities that I need. Mm-hmm. But in this game, you know, whereas in Metroid, you go around and you collect power-ups. And they let you do new things that let you solve puzzles. They let you get to places you couldn't get before. In Tokitori 2, you collect knowledge. You go around and you see things happen. You see animals behaving in a certain way, or you know the game will give you a setup in which they kind of force you to learn that when you're dripping wet with water and you do a stomp near an electrical enemy, it will kill that enemy.
Right.
And that's not something I ever learned the first time I was playing through. I mean, I played, I'm guessing, at least half of this game before the Plus version. But I did it in – I kept coming back to it over and over. I felt like I would make almost no progress. Every now and then I would break through, but then I'd get stuck again almost immediately. And I felt like I wasn't really learning the things that I needed to learn to play the game better. And with the Plus version, I don't think they've made it easier. I don't think they've really rebalanced anything. I think what they've done is sort of streamlined the way that the game leads you around. They've made certain things more obvious, and they've also made it, I think, a little more attractive to take the ideal path. You know, they certainly don't block you out of taking tangents or going down a more difficult route, you know, or finding a secret. They don't block you out of any of that stuff. But this time, the secret path is more of a secret, and the it's more that the correct path or the best path to take for a newcomer is more obvious. So they just do things that make it a little more clear that, hey, if you don't know what the hell's going on, you should go this way and not that way. And that was, I mean, it seems like a weird thing, but that was a big problem with Tokitori 2 the first time I played it. I felt like I was getting lost. And this is a 2D game where you can't jump. So, I mean, nominally, you can only go left or right, and yet I was getting lost. I mean, how does that even happen?
Yeah, you know? I kind of like that, though. Like, I would try to get to a certain place, and then I end up somewhere completely different. And I was like, oh, wow, what the hell? It kind of gave me the feeling of, like, yeah, a good feeling of exploration.
You know, I did like it at first. I liked that feeling, but after a while, I felt like I wasn't really moving forward. I felt like I wasn't really progressing anymore because I'd kind of gone down a little bit in so many different paths, and I couldn't remember where I'd been, and I couldn't really remember why I had to stop at any of those places and turn around and go back. So another thing they do this time is as you move around on the overworld, they leave a trail of feathers behind where you've been. So when you look at the map and you sort of see, where do I want to go next? You can actually see where you've been, and that helps a lot. Hmm. So it's a lot of fairly minor touches like that, but I'm finding that I feel so much more like I'm actually on a sustainable path through the world this time, and I feel like I'm making progress towards something real. And actually this time I finally got to the center of the map in the town where this kind of fairly significant story thing happens. I'm not going to spoil it, but I never even got close to that the first time I was playing, and I've played it even less this time. It's just that the path was a little more direct to get to that part. And once I get to that part, I feel like I actually understand what's happening in the story and in the world a lot better. And I feel like I sort of know what I'm supposed to be doing. Like, what are my objectives in this game? What's the end goal here? And, you know, that's tough because the game has no text. So they never come out and really tell you that. There are also, they don't really have cutscenes or anything. So like it's like they need for you to discover the important things in the game. And what's key with Tokitori 2 Plus is that they sort of guide you to those discoveries a little bit better. Mm-hmm. It still feels like you're discovering them when you get to it, but I'm not getting lost. I'm not meandering the way that I was the first time I played it through. It's weird. Like, I remember the first time I played through the game back in the spring and the summer, I would get into like a really deep, complicated puzzle and would sort of accidentally figure out the solution just from being really frustrated and just like trying everything I could possibly think of. I might accidentally figure it out. Whereas going through this time, I'm actually getting to the places in the game where they sort of teach you those mechanics. So in other words, I feel like I definitely am playing the game in the best order possible this time, whereas I wasn't last time. But I wasn't intentionally trying to take like a torturous path through the game last time. That's just how it happened. So right. It was so unguided that you could just get frustrated and give up. And it was almost more like, let's say, the first Legend of Zelda, where there really aren't any clues about where the next dungeon is. It was the design of the game felt more arbitrary. It felt like you could very easily get in over your head. And then you compare that to like Link to the Past, where the world is still very open and you can still explore a lot, but they have things in there, in that case, a lot of text in Link to the Past, but they do have a way to sort of guide you to the next thing you should be doing. While certainly they still give you the freedom to go off that path and go try different things and go, you know, get more powerful or just kind of go explore a little bit, but you still know where to go. And in Toki Tori 2, I never knew where to go. I never knew what the hell was going on. I didn't even know if I was in a place that I was even supposed to be in yet. You know, I just kind of felt out of my depth all the time.
I'm glad that the you know, the game is improving on that aspect. I think you're overstating perhaps a little bit just how confusing Toki Tori 2's level design is.
It was confusing to me to the point where I was probably not going to play it anymore because I felt like I was so lost that I couldn't even describe to someone my problem and ask for advice because I didn't even like. There's no names of these places.
Right.
The map was almost completely useless. You know, it's just like I didn't even feel like I had the tools to explain to someone where I was stuck.
Well, there's always did you try the Miiverse? Because you can take with the screen grab and everything. Like, isn't that enough for most cases?
I tried that. I tried watching some YouTube videos. I just never felt like I was understanding how things are pieced together, and now I do. So for me, I feel like it's a much, much better experience. And I know people. I mean, my friend Kevin told me he beat the game like a week after it came out. I mean, he was a huge fan of the first Toki Tori. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, you are definitely smarter than me because playing that game, I just felt really confounded by it most of the time. And now it's not that it's easier. I think it's still challenging and you can still get stuck. But when I get stuck here, I know that it's just because I need to try a little bit harder to solve that puzzle because I know that I want to get to the other side of it. Whereas the last time I would get stuck and I think, well, I'm probably not even really supposed to be here anyway. Maybe I should retrace my steps and go try a different path. Hmm. And that's a way to play the game, but it's frustrating because at some point there's so many loose threads that I don't even know where to pick up and try again.
Hmm. Maybe I'll try playing through the game again with this update. I did finish the game, but I never got all the little things that you can collect. So I might try.
Oh yeah, the little pieces.
Yeah, but also there was like a weird case where there was a spot where you can basically move teleporters around, and I moved one in such a way that it led me to an area that I wasn't supposed to go to. At first, I thought, oh, okay, I'm in a secret place now. And I walk to the left and the right, and I go through the walls, and I'm, oh, I'm not supposed to be here at all. Something has gone horribly wrong.
Oh, you just broke it?
Yeah, but I was able to get back on track. But it was, you know, I thought, oh, okay, that's cool. But apparently, the developer also added some extra secrets with this update. And I'm wondering if, you know, like they didn't try to find spots like that where people could go to and, by mistake and added an actual secret there. I think it would be interesting to see. There's probably one thing that we should mention, and it's that the developer had been working on a level editor and had been working to get it on the Wii U. And unfortunately, they posted a blog post saying that it's just not possible at the moment. The game hasn't sold well enough, and it's more difficult than they expected to get the feature working on a Wii U. They explain it all in detail in their blog post, but to ask for forgiveness, they're basically giving Steam copies to any Wii U owner who asks for them. So,
wow,
yeah,
that's very generous of them. I mean, I have to say, I really don't care about a level editor. This is a kind of game that the puzzles are so well crafted, and they're so snugly fit into the world that's been created here. I really am not interested in playing someone else's version of these levels. I would only want to play more levels if they came from the developer and if they were sort of tied into the world in some way. You know, because that's kind of the joy of it is that the world does feel very continuous. It feels like one place picks up where the last one left off.
Yeah.
And I'm not very interested in playing like a level pack for a game like this. It's, to me, it is much more of a journey across an unknown land, you know, as strange as that might sound for a puzzle game, for a puzzle platformer. So anyway, I recommended it before. I can actually much more highly recommend Toki Tori now that the Plus version is out. I am enjoying it a hell of a lot more this time than I was before. And all the stuff that I did like last time, like all the beautiful graphics and the very charming sounds and the the animations and just the really clever way that the environment plays into the puzzles. All that stuff is still there. It's just it's a lot harder to get lost now, which I think is a good thing. So why don't we go back to you, Guillaume, for one more game?
Yeah, sure. I revealed my hand earlier. I said I bought games, plural. The other game I got off the VC was Rayman, the Game Boy Color version. Now, actually, like, I've played the original, or a port of the original Rayman game for PlayStation 1, and I kind of hate it. It's a really, really bad game. It's really beautiful, but I had huge issues with it. Just the fact that Rayman didn't seem to have abilities that were suited for the platforming environment that he's in. You know, like, you've got all these enemies that are knee-high, and Rayman can't attack them. He punches too high, and you can't just crouch and punch.
So it's Shantae, basically.
Yeah, I guess so.
There is a lot of that in Shantae.
that's terrible. But it is
terrible.
This kind of design, I thought, wow, it's as if the people who created the Rayman character and the people who made the levels never talked to each other and just decided, okay, we're going to put this guy in here and whatever, hope it works. And the game is very difficult, and I don't know, like, it was beautiful, but whatever. But I had heard that the Game Boy Color version was actually better. So,
yeah, Craig Harris used to say this a lot. I remember he wrote a really glowing review of it for IGN Pocket back in the 2000 or 2001 when it first came out. And I was really curious about it at the time, and I never got around to playing it.
Yeah. Now, this game looks good for a Game Boy Color game. Of course, it doesn't look as good as the PlayStation 1 version. That's to be expected. But they did do a lot with what they had here, what the Game Boy Color was capable of. So it's a very beautiful Game Boy Color game. And the game seems to have the same themes, like the levels look like the levels from the original version, except that they seem tweaked, like they seemed a little bit easier. I haven't had as much frustration with the enemies that are knee-high, you know, like I haven't had as much frustration just platforming. In the original version, it was just so hard to make jumps or to correctly gauge just how much distance you were supposed to make on a jump and just how on the tip of a ledge you were supposed to be to make it. And that seems to be fixed somehow. Like, they've really improved that. And so with this this slightly easier game, I find it, you know, much better. If you've only played Rayman Legends or Rayman Origins, you should know that the first Rayman is very slow comparatively. He's not as slow as a Belmont, but he's still, you know, he doesn't come with a running button. And
so when you play the music levels, they're more like ballads.
Oh no, actually that's that's good.
That's a joke.
No. There is actually a music theme level, and this level has you basically slide around. Like, there's a lot of inclines, and you actually go fast in this one. So it's actually, it's pretty cool. But in regular levels, you walk very slowly. You can't charge a punch and move at the same time. So again, a Belmont comparison. But the animation is a little bit longer than a Castlevania game. So again, it doesn't feel good. The combat has never felt good in these games, but there is much less of it. So, thumbs up. Overall, it's just a very pleasant, very well-made, after all, platformer. I'm having a good time with it. I'm the only other Rayman game other than Origins that I've played was Rayman 3 on the Game Boy Advance, and that game was a little bit better made. Like, it was definitely prettier, and it was more, I don't know, my memories are pretty dim, but yeah, like, it was a pretty solid platformer from what I can recall. But this is
I've completely forgotten that there was even a Rayman 3 for Game Boy Advance.
There is a Rayman 3 for literally everything.
Well, yeah. I mean, Rayman 3 hasn't been ported around nearly as much as Rayman 2.
That's true. Rayman 2 literally
exists. They're not that different from each other. But
for your toaster.
Mm.
But yeah, no, but the of course the Game Boy Advance version of Rayman 3 is a 2D side-scroller, so it's almost got nothing to do with what came out in the GameCube, Xbox, and PlayStation 2.
Right. Yeah, Rayman 3 is a 3D platformer.
Yeah, it's more of a direct sequel to the first Rayman, and it was really, really excellent. But, you know, since I can't get my hands on that, I'm playing the Game Boy Color original Rayman, and, you know, it scratches that itch, I guess. It just, I find myself, the 3DS, I've been playing an awful lot of RPGs on the 3DS, and mm-hmm. I'm looking around and what came out this week, Pokemon, Rune Factory, and some third thing from, oh yeah, Etrian Odyssey. And I was just like, really? Like, is this the 3DS only an RPG player? I'm kind of getting sick of it.
No.
But it feels like that.
You could play Monster Hunter on it. I mean,
but I just recall the Game Boy Advance. I had, you know, had two Klonoa games. It had Rayman. It had. Mm-hmm. I remember a lot of 2D platformers, and I kind of missed that. So I'm glad that this VC port exists on 3DS, and I'm glad I played it.
Nice. Yeah, there are a lot of non-RPGs coming soon. I mean, you got Batman coming out pretty soon, which is a 2D platformer in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And you've got Phoenix Wright, Ace Attorney 5. Pretty excited about that.
Yeah, those two games plus
Zelda. Which is also a 2D platformer.
Zelda, of course.
I would love to see a Phoenix Wright 2D platformer. That would be awesome.
It would be.
Oh, boy.
That would kick ass. That'd be hilarious. They could do some really funny stuff with that.
No, there are games that I'm looking forward to, but yeah, like I this year I've just had an overdose of RPGs, I think. Freaking Atlas.
The freaking Nintendo, man. They did two Mario RPGs in the span of like 9 months.
Yeah.
And that is ridiculous.
Yeah, and to get that $30 credit, eShop credit, I had to buy Fire Emblem after, you know, Shin Megami Tensei 4. So that's another really slow pace.
Oh no, well, you had to buy the best game on the system. How terrible.
maybe we'll come back to that discussion.
And you'll be wrong, so it's not even worth having.
All right.
Okay. Well, that is quite enough new business for this week. So we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of our favorite things going on right now in Nintendo.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have a review for Skylanders Swap Force by Neil Ronahan. You know,
what?
He loves Skylanders. does the ability to rip apart his toys send him over the moon, or is he unimpressed? Check out his review and see if you should run... Shit.
More shit to step on in Skylander Swap Force.
Your dog will love it. Check out his review and see if you should run out right now and start pushing the Walmart moms out of the way.
We have a preview of Batman Arkham Origins for the 3DS by James Dawson. James takes a look at this highly anticipated 3DS platformer by Armature Studio, a developer comprised of Metroid Prime veterans. Does that sound like something that would interest you? Find out what it's all about with this preview. Because that's what previews are for.
No. Not always.
That's also what friends are for, Dionne Warwick.
And done. Jesus,
especially,
not to read.
Especially if your friends are psychic.
Oh, now I have to read this. Great.
That's what friends are.
Fuck off! I'm about to read Beyblade bullshit. I don't need this. All right. Carmine Wright has impressions of Beyblade Evolutions for the 3DS. Carmine returns from the wilds to give us a look at the first installment of the Beyblade franchise on 3DS. If you know what the heck a physical wing Pegasus 90WF is, these impressions are for you. Also, I hate you.
These impressions are for no one.
Impressions are for Carmine. What are you talking
Carmine
about?
Carmine is so enthusiastic about just these things that I could never, ever care about, but he always finds something to be interested in, to latch onto, and it's worth reading anything he writes for that alone.
All right, and we also have a feature on the New York Comic-Con 2013. It's a set of photos. Neil and the gang attended NYCC this year, and they came back with a ton of crazy photos. Have a look at some truly disturbing cosplay, Animal Crossing. You did not have to go there, really, and see what the show is all about. Yeah, there's an animal. There's a guy dressed up as the character from Animal Crossing with an axe. It's just disturbing. And his
just
head
cutting
is,
down trees, John. Don't worry about
his,
it.
His head is made of like paper mache. It's just a big like paper mache globe with the Animal Crossing face on it. It's incredibly creepy.
Oh my god.
It's very disturbing.
Very sexual.
Awesome. Okay, well, go check out all of that stuff. Plus, you know, all the podcasts, the PDF magazine.
Oh yeah.
The news, the screenshots, the movies, everything is over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Okay, welcome back to the show. I hope you enjoyed Now Playing. We always do. And now we're going to have a little feature. I wanted to break up the routine a little bit and have a little feature on just the things that we're loving about Nintendo. It's called Nintendo, I'm Loving It. And
we're gonna get sued.
Just because I want to get sued by McDonald's. Yeah.
Don't do the jingle!
It's already out there.
Now we're really going to get sued. But, you know, I mean, I think we do tend to be pretty critical of Nintendo a lot of times. It's sort of the nature of what we do. We spend so much time talking about them, and they're so fucked up most of the time.
Johnny, you're not starting this segment right!
I'm so tired of your bitching. Constant yeah. bitching.
Hey, Guillaume is the positive guy, all right? Come on.
Yeah, sometimes. But no, I mean, clearly we all do this because we love Nintendo. And you know, at the same time, I was thinking, well, you know, it's probably easy for a lot of people to look at this and say, you know, we're jaded now because we grew up loving Nintendo. And clearly the company has changed over the years and we've changed. And, you know, maybe it's a little harder for us to be as enthusiastic as we used to be. And maybe I would imagine that reflects a lot of people's experiences as they get older. But I thought, you know, let's not talk about just only the things that we loved about Nintendo from when we were kids or when they used to do this or they used to do that. Man, remember how awesome this thing was. Let's talk about what we're actually really happy and excited about right now. And not even just not predicting the future. You know, this is not a like 2014 preview. It's like, what's going on right now with Nintendo that has us pretty jazzed? Because I think maybe we don't talk about that stuff enough. So that's kind of the thought I had here. And you know, I figured we probably all have a couple things each sort of in mind, and we'd kind of throw them out to the group and talk about them a little bit. So why don't we start with Mr. Lindemann?
Well, tops on my list as a new Wii U owner is that they are actually taking the time to update the Wii U and add new features to it. Because
that's a good choice.
This was very impressive on my part where, you know, I take my Wii U out of the box when I got it. And I found out that, lo and behold, I could not actually choose which audio output I wanted. If I was using HDMI for video, I had to use HDMI for audio. And I'm like, this is total bullshit. This is just more Nintendo hardware fuckery. It's just total. And so I was ranting on Twitter, this, that, and the other. I was just completely pissed. I didn't really know what I was
going to do. Don't follow John on Twitter.
Yeah, it's not.
And then they fixed it. Yeah.
But, you know, and it was one of those things where I was thinking, you know, am I going to have to get an adapter? I mean, this is just dumb. Every, you know, my 360 and PS3, they've had this in there since day one. And it's just stupid that they left it out.
My TV can do it, which I bought in 2009.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, in the PS3 and 360, I mean, for crying out loud, they're 7-8 years old now. And so for Nintendo to release a brand new console with you know, without a separate audio output selection is just completely idiotic, right? So, you know, I go to bed on a Sunday. On Monday, I wake up, and then I find out during the day that there's a Wii U release. There's a Wii U update released, and it fixes the problem. So, you know, I actually, you know, it's one of those things where I can't really complain about that because you know what? I was bitching about something, and they fixed it. So I can't really ask for much more than that, and that's pretty impressive. And the fact that they're also updating the interface as well. So they're kind of, you know, taking some stuff. They're kind of taking user feedback, and, like, the friends list was very, very hidden. You could never find it. It was on the home menu only. And so they kind of surfaced that out onto the main Wii U menu. So I was pretty impressed by that.
Never mind that we as a group spent like 10 minutes collectively trying to find the stupid menu before we started recording.
Well, that's because they used to let you do that in Miiverse, and I think it's not – I think they – you know, they've sort of combined the functionality a little bit so that it's done more from the system menu now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is really a good thing, but because it is different, right. Those of us who've had the system for longer are a little bit perplexed by it, but it's okay.
And you know, never mind the fact that it took them 10 months to actually release that update, but that's of no concern to me because I just got the console. But
whoa, John, not in tune with that with the theme here. Come on.
No, and okay, to make it more positive, compare these 10 months with the almost 3 years it took to be able to play virtual console games off an SD card.
Go find John Lindemann's rant about cleaning the fridge.
Hey, positivity, guys. Come on.
So they're much faster. They're working much faster. They seem to fix more problems in less time.
But before when they added new functionality, they had to do it as a channel.
Right. Mm.
And that is a huge difference.
Yeah, they do seem to have more access to like the very fundamental system architecture this time.
Right. It's not like they have to add some dumb standalone channel to tell you what the fucking weather is.
Yeah. Which is good. I mean, it means that even if they didn't get the firmware really all that great right off the bat, at least they made the system flexible enough that you can rewrite almost anything, I think, on the Wii U. I mean, you've seen them already deal with like pretty fundamental things. And that's probably only going to continue going forward. I mean, the fact that we all assumed that the way they had done Wiimote, it was probably impossible for them to show Wii game output on the gamepad screen. And that was a total surprise when they added that, you know, and it's like, wow, that's a pretty crazy thing to do considering, you know, it seemed like they had sort of taken a backdoor kind of weird way to get Wiimote to work in the first place. And it turns out maybe
we had assumed they were turning off hardware, right, which is what they've done in the past.
Right. So it looks like that may be a little more flexible than we had considered, which kind of makes me wonder what else they might do with Wiimote in the future. Mm-hmm. So good choice, John. And you know, you as a brand new Wii U owner, we should also congratulate Mr. Carl Castaneda. He also just got one today as of recording.
The new Wii.
Yeah, you can welcome him to the Wii U Owners Club as well. But what you haven't seen as a new owner is the whole series of system updates leading up to that one. So each individual update that they do is not dramatic usually, but they have sort of accumulated to do a lot. And they've done several. I mean, they do one probably about once every 2 months.
Yeah, roughly.
And it's been very frequent. And every time that happens, I'm always excited because even if there's no like big new feature that I'm actually going to use, at least it kind of lets me know they're still kind of keeping tabs on things. They're still sort of checking in.
Right.
You know, they're still actively developing the system itself, which is smart. And it's something that, you know, Sony and Microsoft both did a pretty good job of last generation and Nintendo did not.
Oh, this time Microsoft especially. I mean, they completely redeveloped the OS like 3 times.
Sure. Yeah. And Nintendo could do that too now. I don't think they need to completely redevelop it, but they could if they wanted to. So
neither did Microsoft, but that didn't stop them.
Yeah. True. Well, Microsoft, all their redesigns are about like, how can we put more ads on here? So
how can we better synergize our corporate strategy in the
People have actually started dreading Xbox updates because the ad stuff and because it seems to get slower. And people dread the PlayStation updates because they take so freaking long.
They take 4 years. Yep.
And so Nintendo actually, I think, might be doing the best job of anyone currently. With the other new systems coming out that, you know, I'm sure they've streamlined that stuff a lot. But I think they're doing a really good job with it. It's a good pick. All right. So, James, why don't you go next?
So I'm going to say that everything that I emotionally invested in as a gamer was sort of brought to bear when they released the first trailer for X.
Day of your life.
I've mentioned this on the show. I wasn't able to watch it because I have a job, and I saw a Twitter feed that basically was just losing its mind, like trying to describe this trailer, and I just stopped reading. Like, no, I'm going to see this myself. And as I watched it, it wasn't just, oh my god, they're making Xenoblade with giant fucking robots, whatever. Giant transforming robots, to be clear. It was that when Nintendo purchased Monolith Soft in 2005, 2006?
Yeah, ish.
Something like that. They bought them coming off what I consider to be one of the GameCube's, you know, less appreciated masterpieces, which is Baten Kaitos.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they published Baten Kaitos 2, which is, I think, oversimplified the incredibly unnecessarily convoluted combat system of Baten Kaitos. But they did, and they made this a much more intimate story by how they managed the party, and it was a very, very, very solid game that unfortunately a lot of people didn't get a chance to play because it came out so late. But what I see when I watch this trailer for X was I saw them letting Monolith Soft be Monolith Soft. They were letting them spend as much as they wanted. They were letting them build these really, really just beautiful, intricate worlds. I mean, if you watch the trailer really carefully, you can see there's an online chat. They're letting them experiment there. Even things like when they're naming, you know, they're naming directors, they're naming the composer of the game this far out. This who just happens to be a composer who does a lot of games, shows, stuff like that in Japan. He's also really, really good. Kind of sort of early in his career at this point. And, you know, you think about, okay, people they've let them bring in to do Xenoblade, letting them bring in to do X, the art they're letting them spend money in. They bought an RPG developer over a decade ago, or almost a decade ago. And I don't think they had any idea what to do with them. And, you know,
they finally started letting them make RPGs.
Yeah. They made Disaster and whatever. But they made Xenoblade, and it's a masterpiece. They worked very hard. They were intimately involved in the creation of, oh my god, I'm blanking on the name of the game, and I played it for 100 hours. The crossover game.
Project X Zone.
Yeah, which they created the original, so they were involved in the sequel's development. And then I see all the stuff they're putting into X, not visually, the attention they're paying to things like music, sound, systems. And I'm thinking, they're letting Monolith Soft be the vanguard for everything they want them to do. They're giving them essentially free rein to create the biggest, most amazing experiences they feel like they want to create. And that's the best way to use a team like that. And I'm so thrilled they're getting to do it.
Well, I think it's interesting. It's actually, it's an interesting timing for Nintendo because it was right now, you know, I mean, I think it's pretty much, it's widely accepted that the JRP genre is actually, you know, at one of its lowest points. And
right.
Nintendo really has an opportunity here to be the place to go for epic JRPGs.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason Monolith couldn't drop three of these generations. They used to.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they were sort of underappreciated in what they were producing. They're producing these complicated, semi-niche, but these very detailed games that just didn't have the branding to compete with some other games that came out.
Kaitos is kind of a hard thing to, like, tell people about and get them really excited about.
It is, but you know, if you play it,
as good as it may be.
Because it's truly, we talk about world building in Xenoblade, but the worlds they built in Baten Kaitos are actually really amazing. And how they foiled them over into the prequel is kind of this experience that you get to have. If you've played one game, now you can see where things were 30 years ago. It's kind of a fun trade-off of memory versus this new experience. But just letting the fact they seem to have just free reign to do whatever they want, that is absolutely the right way to handle a studio like that, because they're not going to screw up. And even if they do, the next thing they do is going to be great. So there's no reason to try to just push them aside and say, all right, make something easy for us. Don't do something crazy. Because if they're not doing something crazy, they're not living up to their potential.
And you're especially talking about Disaster, Day of Crisis.
you know, it's there funny. It is. We make fun of Disaster, but Inside Disaster is an experience that is really fun. It is an awful game, but it is so tremendous.
It's an awful game with a heart of gold.
It is. It's just so much fun to play it because you're just like, oh my god,
it's a modern day Kusoge, which you just don't really see anymore because games are so expensive to make. You almost never see a publisher release a game that's like almost deliberately shitty in a really entertaining way.
There's a scene where you have to waggle the Wii remotes and nunchuck up and down like you're running, but instead you're rescuing a dog from under a piece of wood. You're just like, yes, of course. And then afterwards, Ray's heart is beating too fast. You have to calm it down. It's like, yeah, all right, let's do this. This is fantastic.
Why not?
They love what they do, and that I mean,
well, just to go back to X real quickly, I think the it was very significant that Nintendo showed that game so early.
They did.
Like, they're trying to build hype for that game, and it means they're getting behind it in a way that they really didn't do with Xenoblade.
They did not.
I mean, when they first showed Xenoblade at E3 as Monado, nobody knew what the fuck it was, including the employees who were there standing around it. I mean,
nice.
It was like they just threw a trailer over the ocean and said, here, show this.
They probably did.
And yeah. They had no intention of bringing it out in America. They really, no one knew what the hell it was. And the fact that they're showing X in a Nintendo Direct, oh, probably a year and a half at least before it comes out.
And they've shown it two more times since then.
That's right. So
they care about this game.
Yeah, to me, they're showcasing it.
Yeah, and they're not just showcasing it; they're using it to showcase the Wii U because Monolith is doing something that basically no one else is doing on the Wii U right now.
Like I don't know that anyone's doing what they're doing. Period. Anyway.
Right. Yeah. But it also looks very different from your typical Nintendo game, and Nintendo needs to show that. It needs to show that they've got something other than the happy-go-lucky Mario, Kirby, like all that stuff.
And you know, I think more than just the fact that you get a game that is distinct and isn't being built on your platform. If you go back to Skyward Sword, Monolith was involved in a lot of the technical stuff for that game because they learned a lot of lessons making Xenoblade. And I think you have to have teams willing to really push yourself because they're the ones who can come back later and tell their teams, whoa, don't do that. That shit don't work.
Well, yeah. And do you remember the story of how Mr. Yamauchi split the Nintendo software planning up into multiple, you know, EAD1, EAD2, EAD3 because he wanted or R&D1, R&D, you know, whatever, but he wanted these teams to be competitive with each other.
Right.
And you know, having a group like Monolith Soft, they're filling a niche that I had kind of hoped Retro Studios would be doing at this point, which is that they really are kind of showing other teams at Nintendo what can be done. And, you know, and that's very exciting because it sort of raises the bar for everybody else too.
Right. Because I think
Tokyo group, EAD Tokyo, does that as well.
It's really, really exciting for me to see what they're going to do with that game.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you're seeing is that I think they learned a lot from the profile that these games can have if you actually put effort into them, especially in the U.S. I mean,
yeah.
People are thirsty for this kind of game. Not only does Nintendo not make this kind of game very often, but almost nobody. I mean, an RPG on the scale of Xenoblade, there's almost nothing. Like, Ni No Kuni is almost the only other game I can even think of from the past 5 years that even comes close to it. So, you know, this game will gather attention from a large group of people if you make it.
Right.
Even though it seems to have a limited appeal, it's a kind of game that people want so badly and they don't get.
It has a limited target audience, but you will get a high yield percentage of that audience.
That's right. Yeah. Good point. Okay, well, let's move on to Mr. Viette.
Sure. There's this trend that's been going on for a while now in games. Like, I think most developers, now that we have higher fidelity games, we have better dialogue, we have more ability to show, like, tell a story. A lot of developers are using that to make their games more like movies. And Nintendo has also been working on their presentation. And I like the fact that instead of trying to make their games more like movies, they've been using the higher fidelities or the dialogue and the voice acting to basically tell jokes, to make their games funnier. I really love the fact that they had the idea to make kind of a Uncharted-like buddy story where you would have two characters always talking to each other throughout a game, and they didn't make another Uncharted. They made Kid Icarus Uprising. And it's all about, you know, Pitt talking about taking a sauna and having his sacred buns steamed, or, you know, like really, really goofy stuff, but really funny and well delivered. And I just love that. Humor to me is very important in games. Back when I was playing PC games and everyone was playing Half-Life, I was playing LucasArts adventure games because that's just that I was not really interested in a big gritty sci-fi story. I've seen those before, but make me laugh and I'll really stick with the game and I'll really enjoy it, you know.
Well, maybe there's hope for you in Fire Emblem, because that game is a lot funnier than you would expect.
It is. No, it is. And you know, Treehouse is, of course, excellent localizers, you know, like the internal localizers with Nintendo, but I think 8-4 Play worked on Fire Emblem Awakening.
That's right.
So yeah, they deserve a lot of credit. But some of the jokes must also come from the original
Japanese. The original Japanese, right? is pretty much all of the themes of the jokes come from the original Japanese.
Right.
So, all the situational humor is from the original Japanese.
Yeah. So I'm still early in the game, but you've got this guy in a big hulking piece of armor. He's huge, and he's so non-assertive that people don't see him in the room. He's just, at some point in the cutscene, he's just like, hey, I've been here all along. And, you know, like, it's just out of nowhere. You don't see him in the scene. He's just
See, the beauty of that is, depending on who, if you partner him with certain, you know, in certain relationships, you can put these really forceful characters that become his spouse, and their whole relationship's completely bizarre. Like, you get those same jokes, but they're way more intense, because it's like...
I've only got one support conversation with him. It was with a spellcaster, and the spellcaster was basically, this is so weird. When I'm looking directly at you, I see you, but as soon as I turn my head away, it's like you disappear. You must be studied. This defies all the laws of physics.
Yeah.
He's just, can you stop staring at me now? And she's, no, it's for science.
there's a really just almost masochistic character that in the party that if you put them together, their support conversations are just absurd. Like, she's basically just yelling at him, you need to be more assertive. I'm tired of you sneaking around like this. I really wasn't sneaking around, I'm sorry. Like, he's just freaking out. It's fantastic.
But yeah, and another good example of humor, Pikmin 3 is full of it. There's the Brittany, the female of the crew, it is really, like, you can tell from her dialogue that she really, really loves fruit juice. And eventually, like, she describes, she's the botanist or the exo-specialist or whatever. And she describes the Pikmin just gorging themselves on the nectar. And she's just like, yeah, they just gorge themselves on it. It reminds me of home. You know? And you've got also like visual stuff, like you see them within their spaceship and they're just talking to each other, and there's random bits of debris floating around, and there's a rubber ducky, and you know that's pretty cute. But eventually they capture this character who they had to tie up because he's just destroying everything. And so when you go back to those scenes where they're just in a circle talking to each other, you see the guy tied up just floating around in space. And it's just so unexpected and so funny. And I just love the fact that Nintendo games make me laugh. It's more rare than it should be, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good choice. Okay, well, I'm going to go with something a little less warm and fuzzy maybe than humor, but something that it's very practical.
Death!
No. It's just something that's very kind of cold and practical for me, but it's the eShop. It's something that I've been interested in since they first allowed you to, you know, download Virtual Console stuff on the Wii back in 2006. And the experience has gotten so much dramatically better in so many different ways. But more than that, it's just more useful now. They put more stuff on there. I mean, you can buy brand new, big-time $60 games the day they come out. In fact, you can buy almost all the games now. I think they're slowly filling in the back catalog with things that were not originally put on the eShop. But at this point, almost everything Certainly all of Nintendo's games, even on 3DS, you can get through the eShop, sometimes at reasonable prices even for the back catalog. And, you know, they're doing sales, which is just almost unthinkable a couple years ago. But they're actually doing a lot of sales, and they're, you know, they're very clever. They tie together franchises in interesting ways. Or they'll feature, like a certain set of indie games for sale. They'll do stuff that's themed around holidays or just different kinds of games. Which I really appreciate that. And, you know, I think the eShop has become a place where I enjoy going there to see what they have and to see what's available, what's kind of moved up in sort of the presentation, you know, see what's being featured on the front page. And they will feature games that you might not expect. Like, they're really trying to push things around. They're trying to get you to pay attention to games that you might not otherwise really take notice of, which is very smart. And the whole experience of going in there to buy games or to update games or just to browse and just to learn about games has come so very far over a few years, and it's become a place where, like, you know, like right now I have more games than I have time to play, even on the Wii U. Just over the past week, you know, trying to catch up on things. I still haven't beaten Pikmin 3, you know, or Rayman Legends, and I'm still trying to play all that stuff. And even then, when I get the press release this morning, I'm looking, what's out? What can I download? What can I buy? It's like buying the games has become part of the fun of playing them. And that's not something that I really feel, when I go to a retail shop. You know, I don't like going to stores to buy games. I think it's a shitty experience. It's always been shitty. Yeah. I've never enjoyed it. I've always been like, even as a kid, I'm like, let me buy this game and get out of here. I don't want to talk to this creepy guy. And I really don't like having to drive across town to go do it. You know, I don't like having to give my money to a store that I just really don't like the way they do business. I don't like the way that they treat me when I go in there. I don't like the atmosphere. So for me, the eShop is welcoming. It's convenient. It's fast. They have everything that I want, and they're even getting good prices on some things. So, for me, that is a huge difference in the way that I interact with my system and the way that I use my system. And it becomes a mechanism through which I'm constantly looking for more things to add onto my system for me to play. I feel like I'm building up a library of stuff, and it's happening very organically. And I really enjoy that. And, you know, having moved twice in a month very recently, the fact that all my games are just stored on the system is huge. You know, it's like a lot of the crap that I moved out of my old apartment that actually was able to be saved was games, because I had them up on a bookshelf. And even the ones that got muddy, I could just wash off the mud. You know, they're discs. So no big deal, but it's such a pain in the ass. You know, mm-hmm. I have all these game cases over here, and I wish all that stuff was just on my system. It was secure. If anything ever happened to it, I know I could restore it all. And it just makes it easier to carry. I just like carrying around this box full of games, all my games on this tiny little box that I can put under my arm and carry over to a friend's house or carry into a new apartment. I love that. And the eShop is the way that happens. And, you know, for the future, I can only hope that it gets better. I hope they will add the GBA stuff that they promised a long time ago. I hope they'll add the GameCube games. I hope they'll add Wii games. There's so many Wii games that I would love to buy that I never did. There's so many GameCube, like Baten Kaitos, I've never played, but I no longer have a system that I could even play it on. You know, all my GameCubes and my old Wii were all flooded. And that stuff is, I'm not really eager to go out and buy a GameCube to replace the one that I lost.
That's
you know?
The thing. It's not really worth it. You know, it's the kind of thing where
Baten Kaitos is worth it.
Well, all the controllers and the memory cards and shit that I'd have to get for it, I would much rather just download the games that I'm interested in to my modern system. And that's totally possible. In fact, I think it's almost inevitable. And I'm really looking forward to that. And I'm happy to pay for those games. So the eShop is absolutely one of my favorite things going on with Nintendo right now. I think they're killing it. You know, I think it was a little rough in the early days of 3DS even. But even there, it's gotten a lot better. And on Wii U, I think they're just doing a fantastic job with it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really impressed at how creative. I mean, they're really thinking outside of the box. I mean, more than just, you know, mere sales, which kind of happen all over the place. You know, they happen on Steam, PSN, Xbox Live. Sales are easy to do, but these kind of bundle packages that they have, stuff like that, where you would just be like, wow, I never would have expected Nintendo to even be able to do that from a technical standpoint, you know, but they just, yeah. they do it.
Yeah, and it, you know, even like the upgraded virtual console stuff, you know, like it knows what games you had on your Wii, and it sees that, and so when you go to the virtual console section of the eShop and you're browsing through there, if you already had the Wii version, it's you already see the discounted price, and you're like, that thing's only a dollar. I mean, I'd be kind of dumb not to buy that for a dollar, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially since I just got $5 from the digital deluxe program. Which really should be built into the eShop. I mean, I hope they will sort of integrate that a little bit better at some point, because I don't like that I have to go to a separate website on my phone or whatever to go get that code. But you know, they're paying me to use the eShop, and I'm happy to let them do that. There's lots of stuff I want to pay for. Mm-hmm. So, all right. So we've gone around once. We actually have spent more time on this than I expected, which is a good thing, but, maybe rather than go all the way around again, why don't I just throw this out there? Does anyone have a second thing that you feel pretty strongly about that you want to throw in the ring?
Well, I mean, the one thing I talked about when I first got my Wii U is I was really impressed by Miiverse. And it's, you know, it seems like, you know, when I first heard it described to me, I was like, it's Nintendo's, you know, silly, kind of kid friendly Twitter clone. I didn't really think much of it. But when I actually started playing games on the Wii and, you know, the way that you're kind of prompted, sometimes you're nagged, you know, I'll admit that much, but at the same time you're prompted and it's like, wow, you know, that's, I would love to share, I just did something really, really cool and did something that really impressed myself and I would love to share it and just leave a little tag, you know, on this one area that I beat. And, you know, it was just really impressed me how it was such a brilliant idea to keep people, to allow that sort of, you know, sharing like you would on Twitter, sharing with other people, but keep it inside the kind of Nintendo world, you know, because sharing, mm-hmm. Sharing to Twitter or sharing to YouTube, any of that stuff, it takes you outside of the game world kind of thing, you know, whereas, you know, you can sort of, you know, you hop onto the Miiverse and you're kind of in this little world. Where, you know, you can go there and everything there is Nintendo focused, and all the comments that you're going to see are Nintendo focused. Any of the game hints that people have are all going to be Nintendo focused. There's no white noise. There's nothing that you have to wade through, right?
Well, there are some posts that you have to wade through.
Well, there is crap, anything that you see in there, anything that you see in game is going to pertain only to that game. But it's going to be stuff that you know, you'll see somebody's comment and you'll say, wow, that's exactly the way I felt when I did that, you know? So that's really, really cool. I was really impressed by that, and I actually liked it a lot more than I thought I would. I thought it was a lot more clever than I thought it would be.
Yeah, and you know, we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, but the Miiverse is also a place where they're very actively developing it and improving it in some pretty impressive ways. Miiverse has actually changed quite dramatically since it first came out. And, you know, don't they now kind of have that Art Academy thing sort of integrated into the system UI? So if you have that, you can use all the extra tools when you go in to do a Miiverse post.
I think you can.
Something like that. I mean, I know you can. I mean, obviously you can post things that you create within the Art Academy app, but I think it also integrates somehow into the Miiverse interface. If it doesn't, maybe they'll do that in the future. I think they could, which is pretty awesome.
Another thing that I really like, and it's, you know, it's often taken as a negative. It's Nintendo doing their own thing and not really copying what the competition is doing. You know, we always berate them for not, you know, for taking so long to get online. But at the same time, so I think that there's a lot of negative trends that they don't adopt, and I'm really, really thankful for that. And you know what, like the main thing that comes to mind to me is stuff like that are so anti-consumer, like season passes or retailer specific downloadable content.
Yeah,
and I'm, you know, Nintendo could do that, and I'm like, there's no, I guess they always could, like in the future, But right now, I'm really, really happy that we're safe from that, that I don't have to worry about not getting the Tanuki suit because I did not buy Mario from Amazon, you know?
I don't think you can buy it from Amazon anyway.
Or, you know, I'm glad that I don't know far in advance, okay, well, you can pay $60 for the game, and you also have to pay an extra $20 because we're going to give you, like, 28 downloadable costumes for Super Smash Brothers.
Oh, man, I'm so glad they don't do collector's editions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That stuff drives me crazy.
Yeah.
That stuff drives John broke.
Well, that's the thing. That's some of that stuff. I mean, it's what I don't like is, you know, what annoys me is the fact that sometimes I just don't feel like I'm getting the best version of the game just by getting the standard version, which obviously is the whole point, but
that's exactly how it's engineered to make you feel.
It's the same psychology of we'll make the large drink, you know, just like 10 cents more. It's just like, well, it's right there. I could just get this better version.
Right.
Yeah, it's totally playing on your human psychology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that stuff has stopped working for me, I think, because I think when I see a game, okay, and there's DLC planned, okay, I'm going to wait for the special edition, and by the time the special edition rolls out, I just, oh, well, I've got something else to play. So, I'm glad that Nintendo doesn't.
So, I will say, though, Nintendo is doing DLC now. They're not super aggressive with it, but they are doing it. And Fire Emblem, which was their first game they did it in, although it wasn't the first game in the Western markets they did it in, it does have what are essentially packages.
Right.
And I actually really enjoyed I enjoyed the fact that these things, I could buy a discounted set of them, but I hated that I would buy it, and then I'd have to wait a week, sometimes maybe 2 weeks, to get all of the stuff I paid for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it is sort of fundamentally the same idea as a season pass, but with a season pass, you're probably going to be waiting months. And also with a season pass, they don't just sell it through the game, like in Fire Emblem. They will sell you a season pass before the main game even comes out.
Yeah. I agree. But it was still that same sort of like, I've already paid for this. You've already made it. It's been out in Japan for a year. Why can't I just get what I've already paid for? And it was like, well,
They might have been actively localizing the DLC after the main game came out, though.
Yeah, I mean, but it was still the same kind of like, man, I really wish the game would just let me play what I've already bought.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it makes sense that, you know, part of the appeal of buying the pack is that maybe you get earlier access to the other pieces of it.
Mm-hmm. That right, it's otherwise just would be money.
Yeah, that would otherwise come out one week at a time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that's a fair point. But in general, they have done a lot of DLC this year, and I feel like they've done it really smartly and really fairly, and they're releasing stuff that I'm actually interested in, which is not the case for most game companies right now.
Sure.
Right. And they're not, you know, you don't get the feeling or, well, yeah, I'm not sure if it applies to all the games that have DLC, Nintendo games that have DLC, but for instance, with New Super Mario Bros. U, you don't get the feeling that they had these levels ready, the Luigi levels ready before they sold you the game.
No, because the game came out a full year later.
Yeah, and I don't feel like I'm missing anything by not having it, but I want to buy it.
Right. Right.
You know?
Because their games are still robust. They're still packed with content before the DLC.
Exactly.
Which is the way it should be.
It's impossible to think that Fire Emblem is lacking content if you don't buy the DLC.
I would like it to have more dungeons.
Well, not to mention that half the DLC for that game is free.
It was. It's not now.
They push you.
Oh, that stuff. Yeah. I mean, that stuff's on the disc or on the cart, though. I mean.
Well, okay. So yeah, it's more like the Professor Layton puzzles.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
But yeah, that is stuff that they unlock for free. It would, to me, and also, I mean, it's, I like how they're doing it. There's some cases where I think there's a slippery slope, obviously, and they're still really early in their DLC lifespan, so it's hard to judge ultimately how they're going to be a purveyor of this revenue format.
Sure.
Going forward, until we see more of what they do.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, like in this case, I'm not sure if, you know, their DLC philosophy is a result of what they believe DLC should be, or if it's because they're late in the game.
Right, trepidation.
But yes, I don't care. Like, the result is the same. For the consumer, I think they're doing the right thing.
For now.
For now.
Yes.
And I'm enjoying it.
Yeah. All of these things are evolving, especially when we're talking about stuff they've just started doing recently, so they could totally fuck it up later.
We do reserve the right to hate them at any time. For really any reason.
Or for no reason. I mean, why prejudice just people who have reasons to hate them?
Yep. All right. Well, let me throw out something that I don't think we'll be complaining about a year from now. I think this is a permanent change, and it's been very long awaited, and it can only be a good thing, and that is their support of the indie developing scene. Which it seemed, I don't know if you guys remember when they first announced WiiWare, but they made it sound like anybody can make WiiWare games. We want to unleash the creativity of anyone in the world who wants to make a game with our crazy new
game with sticks and whatever.
Yeah. And it was like their heart was in the right place, but they had no idea what they were doing, and they screwed it up so bad. And frankly, the Wii just wasn't built to deal with. I mean, the Wii was really not really built for download games. Like, no, it supported it in a very token way, but it really was so hamstrung by size limits and by
financial problems. They pretty much had to hack the Wii to get all those, really to make it suitable for downloadable content.
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, they literally hacked in your SD card as a storage solution.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, without that, you wouldn't have even been able to hold more than a few anyway, you know, because I think when they first designed the Wii, they're like, why would anybody want to download more than 2 or 3 virtual console games? It's like, well, because you're eventually going to release 500 of them, not to mention a few hundred WiiWare games that might be interesting. So like maybe.
Like 30 WiiWare games and 200 terrible ones.
But, you know, and so they had the right intentions with WiiWare. But the system just wasn't ready for prime time. And now with the 3DS and with Wii U, they have the tools to actually make this a reality. And the independent development scene is way, way, way more mature than it was back in 2008. So there's more interesting stuff being made now, stuff that's worth your time, worth looking at. And a lot of it is actually coming to 3DS and Wii U. I mean, for all the third-party problems that Nintendo has with these systems, really with both systems, they have severe third-party support problems. But I kind of don't care because the indie scene is so bountiful. There's so much stuff coming right over the horizon. 2014 is going to be crazy for indie games. Like, we're going to be talking about as many indie games as we do anything else. I mean, just even, you know, earlier in the show, I talked about Tokitori 2, which did come out on WiiWare. And amazingly, that didn't bankrupt the company, and they were able to go on and make a sequel eventually. But, you know, the fact that they can publish a drastic update to their game and basically overhaul the entire way that they guide you through the experience, and they didn't have to jump through a bunch of crazy hoops to do it, is just, it tells you exactly how far Nintendo has come. I mean, the fact that one of my favorite 3DS games that I've played all year is like an $8 game made by 5 people in Europe, and that's SteamWorld Dig, I think is one of the best 3DS games released this year. And you can't even imagine that game ever being done on, even on DSi. You just really couldn't imagine a game of that quality.
You're
that
right,
scope.
Because it wasn't a notebook.
I mean, well, and that the same developer made DSi games.
Yeah, there were some good ones.
But they weren't nearly this kind of scope. I mean, you couldn't make anything on DSiWare that would like be mistaken for a retail DS game. And you can totally do that on 3DS.
Shantae was DSiWare, and I think it got pretty close. It was short, but the production values were pretty high.
The DSi trade-off was either the production values were relatively pedestrian, or the game was tremendously short.
Yeah. And so Shantae went with the latter there, but you know, it's also easily one of the most impressive DSiWare games, and you know, over 5 years, I think there's almost nothing that compares to it. So you know, and 3DS is just, it's so much more open. It's so much more capable. And there's so many more developers who actually know the difference between making a game that people want to talk about, they want to share with their friends, they want to post about it on Twitter, and making, you know, shovelware crap that kids will buy because it's the only thing they can actually find on the store. You know, and to me, the 3DS eShop is a completely different landscape than the DSiWare store ever was. And the quality of games that you're seeing on it are just in a completely different league. And there's still crap on it, but there's also really amazing stuff that you can actually find and that's actually being promoted. Right now, as we record, SteamWorld Dig is on sale which is crazy because the game only came out like 2 months ago. But, you know, clearly they realize that the word of mouth is the best thing this game has going for. They put it on sale. They're going to get even more word of mouth this Christmas season. So they're very smart to do that. And, I think Dan Adelman and his team or whatever that they've got going, they're clearly talking to tons and tons and tons of people. And they're saying, look, we will make it incredibly easy for you to release your game on both Wii U and 3DS. And you look at these Kickstarters that are out there now, you know, you got Shovel Knight coming in probably before the end of the year. There's so much stuff coming up from indie developers, and it's some of the most exciting things being made for either one of these platforms. And, and I think this is an area where Nintendo not only competes with the other platforms, they're probably doing a better job, certainly than Microsoft, and maybe even better than Sony, or at least they're competing very directly with Sony over indie support.
But the thing is, they're not having to be as, you know, pay to play-ish on that stuff because they have a certain emotional investment that a lot of these developers have in Nintendo hardware.
Right.
Yeah. They really...
Well, and they also have just... You know, because their platforms are unique, there are certain games that are only going to come out on 3DS and Wii U
right.
from indie developers because they want to use the dual screens or they want to use the gamepad, and they can't do that with Sony systems.
They still had the enthusiasm advantage before; they just weren't able to channel it.
Right. Exactly.
And now they can.
I mean, look at how many people wanted to make games on WiiWare, and they scraped together. And they finally got it out there, and then it sold 10 copies, and they never got paid for it. It was just a complete disaster, you know. And so now they actually have the technology, and the company attitude has shifted so that they can actually make this work, and they're making it work. And it's even now, it's still in the early days, and it's already been a huge deal for me on both platforms, and it's going to ramp up exponentially over the next few months. So I'm very, very, very thrilled about it.
So am I.
All right. Well, no one said Mario, but I'm pretty fucking happy about Mario too. From what we've seen.
Can I say I'm really, really happy about Miis?
No.
No.
You cannot.
Yeah. No.
Get out.
They're awesome.
You're all fired. Everybody's
like,
fired.
Very cute, very idealized versions of everyone I know, and they clap when it's my birthday on the Wii U home screen, and it's just it warms my heart. I want to see Miis in as many games as possible, just dancing or doing stupid things. It's one of the definitely the best character that Nintendo has come up with in a decade.
Wow, you're so wrong, but I don't want to get into it right now because we're
fight,
gonna,
fight, this fight, is a happy fight, show. Fight, fight, fight.
This is a happy show, and we're gonna go out on a happy note. So I hope you guys enjoyed.
You're gonna
that.
Go out on a dead note, Guillaume.
we're trying to.
I hope everyone enjoyed that little discussion of all the things that we're loving. And why don't you tell us what you're loving about Nintendo right now? You can send emails to RFN.
And if you make a McDonald's joke, I'll hunt you down and kill you in your sleep.
At NintendoWorldReport.com. You can also find a link to each and every article about the podcast over at the website, and I hope you will do that. Before we go, a couple of quick notes. First off, I wanted to mention, I know a lot of our RFN listeners also listen to my music podcast called Discover Music Project. It has been on a little bit of a flood-induced hiatus for the past couple of months, the last two episodes I recorded that are yet unpublished, I am told have been recovered from my waterlogged hard drive, and I should be picking those up tomorrow. So I'm hoping by the time that we record next week, I will either have already published the next episode or will be about to. And actually, the next one is really interesting, I think. It's going to be about the band Vampire Weekend, which a lot of people have a pretty strong reaction to that name. And it is kind of a terrible band name, but it's actually a really good band, and it's worth learning more about them. There's actually a lot going on with that band. So I hope you will check that out. It may or may not be up by the time you hear this, but I'm hoping very soon afterward. And then after that, I got a show I did with Andy Gergen from Connectivity. So more coming up on that show. I hope you will look it up. Just search for it in iTunes is the easiest way. And then also wanted to let everybody know that we are, in fact, getting going with the planning for for the telethon this year. I'm not running the show this year. I asked Carl to help me out with it just so I could sort of devote some energies to other things, but I will still be involved. All of us will be involved, from pretty much the whole damn website staff will be involved. We'll have special guests and, you know, all the things that happen with the telethon, but just mainly wanted to let people know they could sort of mark your calendar, do a little save the date for November 23rd. It's a little bit later in the year this time. It is actually the Saturday before Thanksgiving, and I think it's like the day before Mario comes out or something like that. So it's right in the thick of the holiday gaming season. So we should have plenty to talk about, and I'm really, really, really looking forward to it, really excited. So it'll be another one of these 8 or 9 hour crazy extravaganzas. We're raising money for Child's Play. It's a very good charity, and we'll have a lot of fun. There'll be lots of, you know, call-ins, listener interaction, crazy stuff like that. We have some big plans for it, and I'm not going to reveal any of the specifics right now, other than to say it will be on Saturday, November 23rd. It is a live event, so I hope you will sort of try to set aside a little bit of time that weekend to come participate.
This is our fourth
year? It's the fourth annual, yeah.
Oh, my God.
It's pretty crazy, dude. Yeah. It's an institution.
It's becoming
oh
that.
Oh, my God.
I know. So it's a big deal, and a lot to look forward to there. So that is it for this episode. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Don't forget to send in your emails. We will probably read some of them next week. See you then.
Bye.
Later.
Bye.
Yeah, I'm faced with the process. I still don't have my 3DS back from Nintendo, but when I do, I should be able to re-download Fire Emblem, but I won't have my save file, presumably. So I'm faced with the prospect of starting that game for the third time from scratch, and I'm not sure that I...
Oh, God, I'm not ready to hear you talk about that game for a third time.
Yeah, I don't think I want to. I don't think I want to play that. I mean, it's too bad, because right before the flood, I was playing it again, and I was getting a lot farther, and I was really sort of getting into the groove of it.
It's a fucking masterpiece.
But I don't think I can play through those first 15 missions over
again. It's a fucking masterpiece.
Like,
oh, I can't do it again. I can't. We've gone too far this time.
You know what, James? Maybe in like 5 years, but not the third time in the same year.
We will get back to this in a future episode.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that is quite enough new business for this week. So we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of our favorite things going on right now.
I still have to play it, James.
Good, because it's a fucking masterpiece. You have to play it.
All right.
You don't get to not play once in a generation masterpieces, John. That's not how this works.
That's not how I roll, James.
Oh, you're off the show.
Please,
you're done.
You don't get to kick him off. Come on.
that's only Johnny. Johnny releases.
No, I don't get to either. At this point, I think you're on an entirely voluntary basis, John.
Johnny,
if I kicked him out, would he ever know? Well, like, John, would you?
I'd be kicked out of Canada. I could never return to my home country. That's clear.
You're a man with no home. All right.